Well, let's see. Testing, testing. See if it's working.
So what do we want to talk
about? Well, lots of things. Lots of things.
My strongest interest is in the Philadelphia A's because, as I mentioned, I'm working on a biography of Connie Mack, which, of course, is the whole story of the A's. But I don't want to start there because we've got such an interesting career that I want to find out a little background first.
Okay.
I wanted to know, looking at your record, I see a few games in 33 and 34 with the Missions and with Omaha.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you're 17 years old. Were you signed by a scout, or did you just walk into the Missions ballpark?
No, I was signed to playing for the American Legion and the different teams in the Recreation League in San Francisco. And they were backed, the last one I played for was backed by the Mission Reds. So, they had not any reason to say I had to sign with them, but they did exactly just before I was 17. Then he called me up to the office with my father, and I said that they'd like very much to sign me to a professional contract. But it was something in those days, as you know, it was right in the middle of one of the worst, Great Depression.
Yeah.
It was very bad. Dad wasn't working with four kids in the family. I think you'd make a couple of bucks in those days, man, make $100 a year. He was doing well.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, they called us in, we sat down and talked. They said they would sign me to a contract for $150 a month. Jeez, $150 a month, that was like firing a mint someplace. So which we did, and I signed out of high school, didn't finish high school, actually. I had to go back. The story refers to it. Truman officers coming out and looking for me, things like that. Fred Hoffman was the manager. I'd work out with them in the evenings, but in the mornings or the daytime, I couldn't do it because the officer was there looking for me, and he wouldn't let me play. So I got to go back and finish the school, so I told him, I'll go back to continuation after the season. So he wouldn't buy it. So anyway, I did play intermittently, and when he wasn't there, he didn't bother me.
Were they playing night games?
Oh, yeah, we were playing night. That was 1934. Mm-hmm. Night games, night games and day games, of course. We were missing rest, which very few people mention that there were two teams in San Francisco, even to this day. That's why a lot of these guys call me and say, hey, come on down. Coast League's having a reunion. I said, well, anybody from the Mission Reds? They say, who? Said, that's all. You just lost me. Just lost me. You guys don't understand that. If you're involved in knowing what's going on in the Coast League in those days, you must have known that there were two teams in San Francisco. And I went on from there. I just told them, no. I said, I'm not associated with people. I didn't play with the Seals. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I continued my career from there.
Well, in 34, though, you didn't get into many games. 34.
No. That was supposed to be in school, I guess.
And they sent you out to Omaha?
They sent me there for about 2 weeks or less, and I lost about 10, 15 pounds I couldn't afford to lose. And they were very concerned, so they sent me home. And I guess I was down about 135 pounds. I don't know what it was. Weather and change in areas and what. But I wasn't doing too well. I was under the doctor's care for about 3 months. Filling me up with different things to move my body.
Did they find some cause?
No, it was just, they thought I had a bad cold, yeah, but they thought I had tuberculosis at the time, which was a bad thing, of course, but I did not. I just run down.
You're $150 a month. Helping to support the family then.
Oh, the whole family.
Yeah.
We were having a lot there. A lot of money to be involved in those days.
Yeah. And so the Mission stayed with you. And
oh, yeah.
And then it became a regular in 35.
Right, because they have different people in those days coming down to the Coast League. There were a lot of teams in the Coast League that could have played in the Major League.
Mm-hmm.
But they were older guys. They had plenty of ability, and they did very well out the Coast League. So look it up.
Yeah.
But it was one of those things that the big leagues had the American Association primarily, and the International League was there. Place to put AAA players,
mm-hmm.
because they were close to the proximity of the major club.
Yeah.
And that was the answer to it. And they also figured that, well, fellas in the Coast League were all has-beens going down from the major clubs.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole point of that was that they didn't understand or didn't want to accept was that the existence of the minor leagues, especially AAA franchises, were based on how many people they could sell every year to the big leagues. And that's the way they exist.
Yeah.
That's the way they exist. And so doing, of course, there were a lot of people that were sold out of the Coast League to the major leagues in the 4 years that I could recall. I believe, I'm not positive, but at one time there were around 55 to 60 players in the Bay Area in the major leagues.
Mm.
It was a place that grew up playing baseball.
Yeah. Especially in the early part of the century, it sounds like Mark Koenig had told me about the rec league, all the diamonds that were in action.
That's what it was.
Yeah,
you wouldn't fail to have the recreation league primarily when we were living in a low admission district at the time. There's only one place to go when you finish school or finish what you're doing at home. Out of the park,
mm-hmm.
out of the park, and all it was baseball.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of players throughout the San Francisco area that were mighty good players.
Mm-hmm.
They filled up most of their minor leagues in those days. It was AAA, AA, A. Down, always
down to D, yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of those guys, I couldn't believe it. I used to talk to them, and I was fortunate I stayed in the Coast League, as you saw there. And a lot of those guys were down in those places paying $50, $60 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. I said, and how the heck can you survive? How can you? Well, it's too expensive. You buy a big dinner for 20 cents.
Mm-hmm.
So the economy was in accord with what you were making.
Yeah.
Basically.
You're in with a lot of veteran players, and certainly a veteran than Gabby Street, the manager. I would guess that you could learn an awful lot.
Well, I'll tell you, it was a case of saying that in those days, there were not what they called today teachers. In other words, they had a coach for this, a coach for this, a coach.
Yeah.
They used to come down from the big leagues, and a lot of these guys, you'd watch them and learn from them, and your own abilities would increase by playing more. But no, they didn't teach an awful lot. They'd pick you up once in a while, see you beat this one, try this, and that was all. In other words, my impression and reference is that it was natural ability there, and they were trying to bring it out. They were not trying to say that this is the way it should be, ABC,
mm-hmm.
like with hitting. They used to have a book out on hitting, and it was ABC, position of your feet, position of your hands, position of your shoulders, and all this stuff. Somewhere, I'll just give you a prime example of a reference to it that was not right. If a guy's a natural hitter, and he hits the ball, I don't care if he's standing on his hand.
Mm-hmm.
And a reference to that was, I don't recall, you were involved in baseball then, but Oscar Eckhart, he was one of the greatest hitters in Coast League history. He could hit 360, 370 every year, run like a deer, big guy. And he had the most awful looking stance of plates you ever saw. And then there were other players that came down from the big leagues that had a personal stance or a personal approach to hitting,
mm-hmm.
and no one bothered with you. If
yeah.
you could hit the ball, go get him.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. Now today, they tell you your hand's wrong, this thing's wrong.
Yeah, they got real.
Drive a kid crazy.
You went to Syracuse.
Mm-hmm, 37.
Yeah. And then to Cincinnati.
Finished up in Cincinnati that year.
Yeah.
And next year, I have to premise it by saying this. The reason that this took place, and I have to go back to 1936 when they brought me up, and I told the story a thousand times, but it's true. They brought me up to the big leagues in September of 36. Sent me to New York, flew me to New York to join the ball club in Cincinnati. And Commodore Hotel. The only guy I knew there was Ernie Lombardi. So Ernie came over and said, "Lord, what's going on? We don't talk." And he said, "Well, this is tomorrow. He said, I'll meet you for breakfast and black and ball boys. 3 or 4 of course." But we went out and we were working out. In those days, well, I guess 20 minutes before the ball game started, we had infield and batting practice. Give you 20 minutes. That was it. So I was in the infield, and then a couple of times went up and swung in the bat and so forth. In New York, at Bullard. And I went out to shortstop, which I was playing at the time. And they were hitting balls left and right, and short and so forth. So after it was over, I went up and swung about twice in those days. I said the players were playing that use of the time. And Dressen calls me, this is Charlie Biff. Dressen and Tom Kelly called me over. They said, "Kid, you look pretty good, but I just got to give you an reference to this." This is Dressen talking.
Mm.
He said, "You've got ability, but you'll never be a major league player." And I said, "Why do you say that?" He said, "Well, I can tell. I'm one of the people that can tell you the mannerisms, what you do, and you'll never progress to be a major league player. You'll be a utility player, is what I'm saying." Well, I didn't like that, of course, and they played me different places throughout the rest of the time we were on the road, not in Cincinnati, and the same thing. He just kept telling me that, so a short story, but a long story. 36, I go to spring training in 37, and they have two fields out in Plant Field in Tampa, very big place. And he said, "You don't have to worry about staying here with the major league players, run over there with the rest of the guys. Have you feeling and hitting over there?" And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, you don't belong here." I said, "Again, why?" He said, "Well, you're not a major league player."
Yeah, I know. I can tell.
Yeah, so I went over. And I did this for about 10 days. And I got damn sick and tired of it. So this morning, we woke up after a brief meeting he would have. And there was no calisthenics or anything in those days.
Mm-hmm.
You'd run around the park and come back and throw in a little bit. And then it's not working. So I went up to Dressen and I said, "Charlie, I don't understand." I said, "Jimmy Christmas, you paid a lot of money for me. Made $20,000 or $25,000 two players. Now you tell me I won't be a major league player and you won't give me a chance to make the big ball club." He says, "You understand what I'm saying?" I says, "Yeah, but I don't like it." He says, "Well, we'll see about it." Next day I was at circuit. Gone.
Mm-hmm.
Because I accosted him and wanted an answer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to continue it and say it happened, it did happen. I had four managers. Dressen, Technic, Stangle. That followed me every place I went, that I was not a major league player. Even McKechnie, when he took over in Cincinnati, said to me, "Eddie, I know your background, you have ability, but I agree with Mr. Dressen that you're just a utility player, and that's how I'm going to use you." So, in other words,
mm-hmm.
I'm sitting on that bench and doing this and doing that and going nuts. I knew I could play, say I was any much better than anyone else, but I could play and they wouldn't play me.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to tell them, "I don't like this and I think it's wrong." And one day, and well, finally, McKechnie gave me a chance. I think it was in 41, 42.
Yeah, 41, you played every game.
Yeah, 41. Mm-hmm. And I was the worst player in baseball, I think. I made 40 errors or something. And I admitted that. But a couple of things occurred on the field, and McKechnie called me in and wanted to talk to me about this and that. And I was right about the situation to cover. If I was playing second, I was playing short. I was calling the signs cover or not, and all of a sudden the guy takes off, and I look at Fine, Fine looks at me, there's nobody coming to second base. Paul goes, "I can score it right anyway." Come in, and McKechnie's chewing me out. I said, "Wait a minute, Bill." I said, "After all," I said, "this was a mistake. I'll accept the fact, but I said, I'm pretty sure." And I called Lonnie over, and I said, "Hey, Lonnie, you remember if I gave you the open to close?" He said, "I think you gave it to me." And he says, "I think so." When McKechnie heard that, he liked Lonnie. He says, "I don't believe that." He says, "If you were given a sign to cover, you'd have been there." So now I'm telling you, you were wrong. Oh, you were wrong. Well, that was the beginning of a confrontation all the time. Every time he turned around, it was this, it was that.
was McKechnie the kind of manager who would do that in the dugout in front of everybody else?
Yeah. He would do it, and that's when I like to name another guy that went to it, and he was getting to 500. The whole point of it, again, is that it carried over
mm-hmm.
all the way. And finally, McKechnie got tired of me telling him off. I was right, and I said, Bill, goddamn it, I'm right. I said, I'm going to tell you what I think, and if you don't like it, I said, that's not more I can do but tell you this and that. I just think, oh boy, oh God, to Boston.
Now, I want to back up a minute. Did you learn anything from Bobby Wallace along the way?
Bobby Wallace, I never was involved in, other than to say hello.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he didn't come to spring training and say, this is my man, this is the guy I picked up, this is the guy I scouted. Didn't do that. He'd make reports on the room, and then that would go to the front office. And in those days, again, it was the general manager made decisions. It wasn't the five different people before he got to him. The scouting reference, of course. No, Bobby Wallace, I mean, I've talked to him a few times, but no, other than that, probably he scouted me when I was at Coast League, and beyond that, there was no real conversations about abilities or not abilities or what you should do or not.
They were called the Mission Reds, but they weren't a Reds
Association.
Now,
where I came from, I'd have to read up on the history of it. I'm not positive.
So Cincinnati actually bought you from them.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Wasn't an association.
And Willie Cam. Did you learn anything from Willie Cam?
Oh, Willie, yeah. I learned a lot about playing for the Mets. What a great guy. You know, I kind of and I had some, you know, decent years in the Coast League.
Mm-hmm.
I drove in runs and I played every day and I could run like crazy.
And that was quite, as you said, that's quite a high level to start out. I mean, you're not working your way up from D to C to B.
Well, I could play. I could play. But I didn't make mistakes, of course. I mean, you'd learn from this mistake. They wouldn't put you over and eat your penny out about it. You should have done this, you should have done that. And that's why guys like Dressen and McKechnie became great managers. But they were always involved in their own little way of life to say that this is the way it's going to be, and no deviations. We're going to do it this way. It's my way, and I know I'm the best.
Mm-hmm.
So just to continue that talk with Jason Dressen. He called me over one morning. He brought me in to a ball game. I forget who it was. He used to play the Red Sox a lot. And I was playing third base. And I came in on a short hop ball, and the ball hit me on the wrist, and I booted it. He comes in, he said, I want to tell you something. You played that role. He said, I could have told you that. He said, I'm telling you now. When I played, and he was telling me all about how he was a great third baseman. Baseball. So the next time he came over to tell me, I said, don't you tell me how. I thought he looked up your record and it stuck.
I don't endear yourself to the manager. Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, but the thing kept carrying over. Even I got into that rotten place at that time with Stengel, who was the worst manager in baseball at the time because he had no abilities, including myself. I was probably one of the worst players in the National League. But anyway, it was a during the war.
Yeah. Bob Coleman.
He took over later.
Was a manager part of the time.
Yeah.
And I've heard stories of him in the minor leagues just before that. That he was like every kid's father.
Some
as a manager.
Trying to be.
Yeah.
But the only thing I can say in reference to that is in 1946, I was given a relief, shall I call it, from the Army because I had two children at the time, I was married and so forth. 1946, I was playing third early in the year, about April, I guess, and we're playing with some. Bill Gell, the shortstop, was on first base. Somebody had a ball in left center. It was Gordon Gillenmore. I knew he could throw. So I'm watching, so I'm on the base, watching the ball, and over went in. The ball came over to my left like this, and I grabbed the ball, dove in to tag it. Jurgis, I tagged him, but he purposely just bang, kicked me off the roof. Well, it was part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
So, did the thing I did, and without he got even banged, because when he used to play the chess, that was one thing about him. My God. He'd do up with the spikes that iron there, actually shortstop, and oh, second, and tight kid. And it was a kind of a confrontation between the two. But anyway, I was out for a while. I could catch the ball, could swing back. I was out for that. I was in the middle of the house completely for most of the season until they went on the last road trip, which I think was in September. I was out of part of August. Because in those days, they made 21-day trips.
Yeah.
The whole route. So I went up to the office, and Coleman was there. And,
Bissonette was connected.
He was there at the time.
Yeah.
Coleman was then, I think, was the manager.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went up to the office, and he was there, Mel Bissonette, and Mr. Quinn. And we were talking about so I just explained, I said, this is one thing that nobody talks about reference. I can't do this, I can't do this, because he gave you the complete evaluation as to what took place with this attendance and so forth. And I tried. I said, I can't send it out, and I really can't get you wrong. So I gave him the whole story. I said, the other thing is, this is almost the end of the season, it's the last road trip. 21 days, it's an expensive thing to keep you going in and out of the hotels, not in the life. I said, well, I would like to suggest, if you will accept it, that, hey, the season's over for me anyway. Why don't you let me go home and see you next season? So I cuddled together, this and that, Coleman, Mr. Coleman. And I said, oh, that's a good idea. We appreciate that. We'll take care of your salary. Don't worry. I've got another 6 weeks of salary. But anyway, I had a hell of a time. I got knocked off the plane and then I turned around. So I ended up finally, lost my luggage, everything. Ended up in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I have no change of clothing on. I used to all take showers with all my clothes on. I couldn't shave. So I went up to the desk and they said, hey, there's no way to get out of the seats are taken by military and people have been involved in the war effort since when. There's no way. What about, hey, I got a couple of bucks in my pocket. I said, yeah, how about a private airplane? Well, we could possibly do that. Okay. So it's still relative to a guy. I said, I'd like to be able to fly to LA. I said, yeah, out of Los Angeles, you know, girls. I said, no problem, I'm the one you want to go. I said, oh, as quickly as you say. I said, I have no rooms, I have no clothing. I said, this is it for 4 days. I said, lost my stuff. No problem, it's not good. We got to know. I didn't charge me $200. To fly me to LA, we couldn't get into LA. We dropped me off on some time. I was aware that we should be there anyway. So I waited and waited to find a train for mine. I talked to him about how much it was going to be a good one. So he said, give me $3. I said, okay. So I get to the airport, and I had tickets. So I wasn't able to use because they bounced me off in 5 minutes. So I went up to United. I said, man, here's my problem. I just wanted to see the lady. She says, well, there's three flights. San Francisco. So finally, I think it was the third place to come. Translation, no problems, non-stop. I said, I was on about 2 days, haven't found my own time. A special delivery of a letter. Great. I walk on it. You are your body.
Suspended?
Yeah, the word suspended, but something else prior to it. Because you are suspended without pay for the rest of the season. So I got on the phone and I called and looked at the phone. There's 21 minutes. So finally I went to Judge Landis. I called Landis's office. He got on the phone and he said, no, young man, what is the problem? And I explained to him that I went to the system and verified that that's only by word of mouth this happened. I said, now I've got a black mark in my baseball career. Mm-hmm. And I jumped the ball, which I didn't do. Well, anyway, Lana says, I'll be back. That's all he said. So he called me about one of his people extended my life. We've got a case. Such up in my prep reference, and we'll get together. Next thing, we've gone.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody else was going to meet him. He says, no, no way. And my number was, no, you have no case.
Mm-hmm.
So I was suspended for 6 weeks for that thing. Next thing, no, one in Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
So my whole point to this is that carried through all the way from the very first day I came in Cincinnati. 1946 until
1945. 44. 40, 45 was when you got suspended.
Yeah.
44 you were out.
44 until 45. 46, 45. It was 45.
Yeah.
Then the next year I went to
Rochester. Okay. Yeah.
Well, that was the best thing that happened to me, honestly, because Joe Zidman was the general manager. I had known Joe. My mother was the cardinal. This was a conflict. Walk on the moon. It's not. Don't worry about it. I know all about it. I know you know me. I want you to come play for me. I said, well, Joe, I'll get back. He's a month back to the big league. I said, no, I've been here 6 years. He said, so. And I'll tell you what, it's a flat ball. Really, it's a flat ball.
Yeah, you've got to get off the suspended list to play anywhere.
That's right. So, old point was, he said, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. Stuff at the office and we'll play, you know, take care of it. And I said, well, that's the way out. That's how he took care of it. I had a great year.
Now you got Burley Grimes as a manager.
Oh, well, that's just that. Great place. He didn't bother. I know every day he came in and laughing at him. Had a good book.
Hot tempered, wasn't he? Maybe when he was just when he was pitching.
With the umpires and when he was pitching, he turned all the way around. But with the umpires, he was tough.
Mm-hmm.
But not over the players. He was great. Just told me, hey, I know you're a big league player, and I want you to show me that you can play in the big leagues. He said, man, the big leagues, you get back there next year. So I went over there, and that was the way it was. And Danny Murtaugh was playing second base.
For some reason, Grimes didn't finish the season.
I don't recall why.
Somebody named Benny Boardman.
Benny Boardman. Benny was the greatest guy in the world, too. Great coach, a great comedian, shall I call him.
Mm-hmm.
A real nice guy. And that was the point. That all he wanted you to do was go out with the best you could every day. Mm-hmm. He never criticized. If there was something that you were doing wrong, they could call you and say, hey, screw you up, this you should have been. I said, yeah, that'll happen. Mm-hmm. Happen again. That's the way it was done.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it was a blessing that I did that because you've gotten back in the big mix for another 9 years.
I want to go back a little bit.
Sure.
The 39-40 World Series. How were the World Series shares meetings conducted?
Right in the clubhouse.
And who?
The manager and the general manager of Cincinnati with Warren Jones. They would come in and say, well, now we've got a decision to make as to who gets the shares of the World Series, but it's winning to lose. So it was the vote of the ball club itself.
And all the players were in there?
All the players were in there. The only thing they designate is those that could not play in the World Series and those that did not have a voice in the selection of who would get money. With the 39 series at the Louisville, so it was Bucky Wallace, Derringer, Bandy had been in Indianapolis for most of the year, coming to the ball of the point. They would send him out, they brought him back for his name because he had two strikeouts at 38. Brought him back for his name, and he didn't help us at all. He was all over the place. Just a troll. So someone, I can recall, someone on the pitching staff, Joe Banks, Daniel, Walters, I don't know who it was. I don't think that Van Der Schoen is going to share. He's only been here a week or 10 days before this meeting, and he only pitched early in the season, a couple of games, and went over to Indianapolis. We don't think he was going to share. Giles says, now, wait, this is something I have to tell you. I think he will. It's because he's not even the two more hitters. He said, well, he didn't help us at 39. He said, well, yes. Anyway, went to the commissioner's office. The commissioner told him that we should, because that is a top missing year before, didn't they? So it wasn't, well, as it turns out, it wasn't one of those movies. Losing share that year was $4,600. But anyway.
So you wound up with a partial share.
He got a hunk of it.
Yeah.
No, I didn't know it. They gave him a full share. I gave him a full share, and that was the whole argument as to why he deserved that. And the players, there was no animosity except that these are facts, and this is what it should be. He didn't help, he didn't help us get here. Why should he get a full share?
Is he sitting there at the time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everything was out in the open. There was nothing in the office between 1 and 2. No, it was down out in the open. Every World Series in 40. Called Jack to do it, not giving a full share of the now. But there were two or three guys that came up just before the series, I mean, the season was concluded, and they were not giving a full share of cash money or something. But that's the way it worked, and the players in those days had a say in that, but that's basically the end of the line. They didn't have much to say before, right?
Yeah. What do you how do you remember the play involving Dick Bartel in the seventh game with the double?
Just watching.
What was your impression?
He made a mistake.
Watching
it was just in that case, there's nothing in the world that can tell some guy as an infield coach. Like it says, now if this happens, you write it down, this happens. That does, it's instant. Bartel had to know that it was an out at second base. If the ball gets to him, he's got to turn quickly and look at it. Just that quick, and you see the home plate, and see him run, you throw the ball. He turned around, looked, hesitated, that was it. Just his instinct. He lost his thinking as to what the next play is going to be. In other words, in baseball, like most sports, of course, you got to know one play ahead. If this happens and that happens, you don't say to yourself, now if this happens and that, it's spontaneous. Because you've done it so much, and you know it. There's no reason to say that they're going to write the rules and regulations or how you do this when this happens, how you do it. It isn't like that. It's just bang, it goes to right center, left center, where you should be, what you do, and immediately return to what's the action. You don't, and that's what Bartel didn't do. He hesitated and turned, and then finally turned, and just went.
Yeah.
So he was a. It was a play of instinct in me at the time was thinking about it. So
why was you say Stengel was the world's worst manager the time?
Look up this way.
Okay, well, are players make the manager?
Players that produce make the manager.
Yeah.
That's about it. I don't care what kind of a name they're go to some of these guys and play them later. Don't make the manager. They have their own season. No, but the whole point of Stengel was, you look up his record prior to managing the Yankees, he's a failure. Everyone. In fact, Brooklyn made him a clown. He used to go around with Burns and so anyway, Stengel and I didn't get along because he was living at the same hotel I was living at in Boston. Charles River, opposite Kenmore School. Anyway, he was there also, and they had in the summertime, they had a youth garden, and they had parties up there, and they had dinner, and had a couple of drinks, whatever you want. Yeah. Brown used to crush it. And they'd get drunk and browned off. Then he'd come to ball class sometimes. You know damn well he's on over. But anyway, it started out in spring training. We were in Wallingford, Connecticut. And in so doing, Lefty Gomez was on the ball club at the time. And Lefty and I had been friends for years because we all lived out there. So we got together and we were working on a beautiful big field house. I don't know what a beautiful place that is. very first day that Lefty goes out to a batting practice after about 5 or 6 days left, he's out there throwing batting practice. And all of a sudden, Stengel walks out, hold it, hold it. He jumped. We all came in. And Lefty says, what's wrong? I said, what's going on? Because I noticed it's your delivery's wrong. And Lefty says, my delivery's wrong? Why? Well, you're more here than you should be up here. In other words, you're throwing more sidearm and three-quarter sidearm, but you should be throwing over the top. Because the ball will do this, the ball will do that. He said, for Christ's sake, he said, how do you think I got the record I have? Like throwing up here, no, I'm throwing from here, and that's it. So every time he'd come out there, you know, he'd just say, and he'd go, and he'd yell, is that right, Kate? Well, anyway, it was Casey, again, he had a bad ball club, including me. A season that if someone said that this is going to be the end of your career, you would have admitted it, because there was only one guy that was doing anything, was Tommy Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
He was an individual. He didn't associate with the players or anything. He was an individual, and he went up, he could hit the ball, he gave his base hits, and he did, which he did.
Yeah.
But beyond that, he wasn't part of a ball club. He didn't. What are the abilities when we put in this league? It makes a difference when we lost.
Yeah. Yeah, that was
I'll
sort
get
of
over here. I'm
really shady.
Yeah.
That was, as I recall, a bunch of real veteran guys who were.
Yeah, well, of course, it was the Warriors.
Yeah.
Several guys. Basically. Yes. Well, I ended up being much more. I got into a couple of scrapes. Playing ahead of me, at least didn't belong in the lineup in the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
I had a copy. So anyway, we got into a little bit of meditation. But he was very unsuccessful.
It's safe to say that by now, 1946, 1947, you have what's known as a reputation in baseball?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's when I was sent to Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
First three people. First three men. Mm-hmm. But from one or the other, and stayed with.
Mm-hmm.
Each time you'd spring training, jump. Everybody would say, I'm the manager in 54. Charlie's over at the Saturday. So, Wally Moses and I go over there. Took you out and got him and comes out. Hey, yeah, come here. Charlie. Sure, thanks. Charlie. So, took you to go to the Saturday. I made him stick. Let you know that what I said was not true. I said, Charlie, it's trying to make sense how I'm going to do this, because I got an opportunity and I took advantage of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason I'm one of the better players in the American League here for the next 29 years. Two of us can agree, so I'm the other one's
going to be
the second. Well, I was a good player then.
Mm-hmm.
That was a real good player. Well, anyway, he apologized. I said to him, Charlie, you know, I was the only ball club woman, given by my good friend Joe, both of them. I used to tell him, how do you do that show? Good. He's at it, I'm out of work. I should have asked him to tell him.
Years old now.
I was in good shape. Now I'm quite
And your first meeting with Sinai or contact with him.
So he called me. Great person, honest man, talk to him. Got to where he's coming from. Because Al Simmons was there, and tried to make the carton.
A higher payroll than the Yankees.
Oh,
yeah.
Man, I couldn't believe that.
Yeah.
They were telling people, well, he's got dollars, a dollar, and he's got something, and he's got something, and he's got Al used to go to Parkinson and Hot Springs down there. Also, all the winter, I said, I'll wait a couple months. And I was in shape. He was always in shape. But this one time, Mr. Mack wouldn't sign it. You know that I'm 60. Mr. Mack said, no, I'll sit down. So in the back of the side parking lot, I was able to sell pictures on it. They used to sell the roof.
No, on 20th Street, yeah.
He used to love a lot of those. Allison and Silver Place, all of them. So, opening day. Still hasn't talked to Simmons. Simmons is over there, he's not going to be in the sandwich in my phone. The phone, lady said, Mr. Simmons, Mr. McElroy, Mr. McElroy, this is how you laid the phone. I'll talk to him, so I get down. He said, Mr. Simmons, this is Mr. McElroy. I just want to let you know that I think you're worth all the money you're asking for. Would you be able to play today?
your first actual meeting with him
was in spring training.
In spring training, is that West Palm Beach? And here he's now.
Well, he's up in his late 70s.
He's 85 years old.
In 47 with 85? I thought he was my 82.
So, you're used to dealing with managers who are a whole lot younger than 85. Does that strike you as uncomfortable or odd or anything? Or?
Didn't even enter my mind. Several reasons was I was there. I didn't major league baseball. And the coaches he had were good people. All the people I associated with when I first got there, they were great. Just they were dying ball players, basically, and they were working for Mr. Mack. And there was no thinking as to why the manager was there so long, because he was, if he wished, Telly was very successful. Mm-hmm. Except the times he broke up the club and the club went down. Each time he did this, he had a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
He was still in the middle of a disaster when I was there. And so going, no, never questioned him. He said, "You're my shortstop." And he said, "I'm going to take all of you. You just do what you can do, and I know you can play better than we're in the National League."
Mm-hmm. He was riper than all the rest of them.
Well, you see, I was taught that in the coaching. Gray Hoffman was the first manager. They said, "Hey, don't let him take out of your hands and the thing on bases and all the bat." And this was kind of like the role of the Cardinal.
Mm-hmm.
How to do it. It's one of those guys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The old Giants too.
Yeah, the old Giants. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's the way I was brought up. You had to be aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't be the type of person who's going to simply take it and talk back, and you never get involved in anything. The Roosevelt, the quick story about the Roosevelt. Why he jumped on me, I don't know. Thing is not in the record. And I was playing short. Throughout the game, I didn't realize it, but every time I looked up, the ball was hit to me. Or a double play, ended up 19 chances left. Shortstop. It's never been equal.
Hmm.
Never. I've never mentioned it. But every once in a while, someone called me from the East and mentioned it. And I'd say, "How come it was never mentioned in my reference to how they played here, that year, this year, that year?" And it was. It was a record that's in this game.
May 7, 1941.
In New York.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to look it up, I don't think anyone's ever had more than 19, but at least 19 chances at shortstop in the game. And another thing, too, about it was an attitude. The players were all, when I first knew them, but that's a pretty good thing. Sam Chapman, Payne came on the first game. So, aggressive, tight, pushing punt and one hitter. Pete Suter, no one ever gave him credit for being the player he was. Look at his record. He didn't hit much, but he was a great defensive person. He hit the double play.
Master of the Phantom double play, he said.
We made 217 double plays in 1 year.
Yeah, 2 years in a row, you had over 200.
Over 200. Mm-hmm. The whole point, that was all he said, sure. You had to get double digits, was bringing it on. But anyway.
No, that was quite an infield.
Yeah, it was.
With Hank Majeski and
myself, Suter,
and Payne, yeah.
And we could all throw it. Majeski was very close. Well, it was good or better. Actually, it was better. You could bet so could Suter. It was the same thing now. Double plays, but it was better, right? Maybe 8 feet from the front. Keep back, and make the double play. It was great. Everybody got along. There was no animosity. Chapman was a good guy. Ballard was a good guy. Zernial was a good guy. He came with it. Although, you know, guys like this, I say to myself, I ended up when I was managing the ball club. Zernial lied on the confrontation. And I said, "What's spring training?" I said, "John." I wasn't aggressive being a manager. I didn't want to be aggressive. I just wanted to get along with the guys. Hey, wait. Now, this is something that was asked of me, and the best I can do is the best you guys do. If you play well, I'll look good. If you play bad, I'll look good. That's right. We talked about it, and I went up to guys, and I said, "Guess what? You hit 40, 45 home runs every year, but you let in a lot." I said, "You understand what I'm saying?" He says, "Well, I didn't answer it." "You know, but I have to be cautious. I've broken my shoulder a couple of times. Fell down and was clumsy." Well, anyway, I said, "Guess Wally Moses is one of the better outfielders ever. And if you want him to kind of guide you or suggest something, let him talk to you for a minute." So Wally went out and talked to him and tried to explain to him how to get a jump and how to realize how to go to the left and why and all this.
wrong.
First game of double in the room for five, so about 6-7. That was about 95 degrees, at 95 degrees. And all the system we had to drink, I said, well, hold it. I said, the rest of my life, I went home. I think it was 6-7. The very first guy who had me to go for left side. Well, he and I had a couple of meetings on the street. Look out. And you build it out and out, it won't help us. And the pitchers are talking about. Put somebody else in the game and move on ahead. One or two runs, and because he couldn't throw two runs, he said, get to the ball. Get to the ball.
When you get, you're now in the American League for the first time. Does it take a while to learn the hitters, learn the field?
Well, you do it automatically. As I said, in my opinion, it was the way I was brought up. Wherever we play, you would adjust to what the conditions were. In other words, every infield is different, of course, and you wouldn't go out and pick it apart like you do today. The sand is not right, this is not right, that's not right. In those days, you threw dirt out there and scooped it up the best they could. But no, it didn't bother me, although you wouldn't in your own mind sometimes say, God, this is a bad infield. There were 4 or 5 were really bad. But as a producer, I'd play. Everybody else was playing.
Was Shy Park?
Shy Park was decent. Wasn't worse. It was decent. Yeah.
And what about learning the hitters and the pitchers? Is that something you pick up quickly?
Yeah, no, you go over in the club, I should go over to the hitters in the meetings by saying, which Mr. Mack did do, what we did, Jim Dykes did, and Al Simmons was there, and Cochran, they were the coach. We'd all go to meeting. Mr. Mack would come in and say some things. He was never involved to say that we should miss, that we didn't do that, we didn't do this. But we would have meetings of every hitter. And this was a spring training also. So you pay attention, that's all. And then you talk to the pitcher, and the pitcher says, a situation, a pitcher like this, and this, and that. And now you got an idea of what's going on. So you pick it up because, again, I would say it's baseball at once.
Yeah.
People that play it and are good at it.
The
reaction is what?
Yeah.
You work at different things.
Yeah.
If you can't move your right, it's a little too short. You might get across every step or slide. Have anything just to adjust by getting one more step to get the ball. You do that on your own.
Would you relay the picture signs to the outfield?
Once in a while. Once in a while you do it, but it wouldn't. The point to that is not positive is the fact that the pitch, say, it's a situation 2-2, and you know the guy's when the guy first going to take off, and the outfield wanted to know what pitch was going to pitch. Well, during the time you sat down in the clubhouse, said, well, this situation comes up 2-2, and the guy first, and you've got to do something, you've got to think, wait. So they said, well, yeah, I understand that. And Willie's always going to catch you because he understands that too. And he said, well, we're going to try to pitch it a little bit inside. Not throw a ball, but try to get the strike, but throw it inside. First thing you know, the ball's in the middle of the plane.
Yeah.
It just throws a theory right in the garbage.
They got to be able to do it, yeah.
They got to be able to do the things that you talk about 9 out of 10 times, or say 60% of the time in your face.
If you don't have the pitchers who can do it, then.
Then you got a chance.
Then, that's what it takes. Do you recall? Well, did Connie Mack still call you boy the whole time?
Oh, yeah. I called your son boy. I never called daddy. She was the sons or
whatever.
What? Very first year. First series in Shy Park. I was in the and it was a doubleheader. So I played change your thoughts, and then you change your thoughts. So then you change sweatshirts and so forth. So I was, my sweatshirt sitting on the old clubhouse, big long clubhouse, very narrow, slide from my house and like this. And in the middle of the block, it's only about 5 feet wide down the middle, but the shower's on the end. So, still like it's too hot. So I don't know, the petition reference, and Mr. Maxwell was still here, and the board was all everyone. So the trunks that we used to carry the bats and balls and uniforms were up against one of the walls. So I had a sandwich and a glass of milk. So I went over to the sat on opposite of the office. So I'm sitting there, he came out and he said, "Boy, what are you doing there?" "Boy, it's Mr. Mac, a little too hot in there. I thought I'd stay here." He says, "This is for the players. Now you better not be here when I get back." First year everything. He didn't know who that.
How were you dressed?
I just had my shirt on. Didn't have my uniform. I just had my uniform pants on. And I had taken my shirt off and had just had a little t-shirt on. And he saw me sitting there. He says, "This is players only. You better get out here."
Somewhere along the line, over the 47, 48, 49, 50, he apparently begins to fade. His sharpness begins to go.
Yeah, you could see it.
Could you see it in 47?
No, not too much in 47, but from years on, we just pay attention. What if I was like in 48? We could have won the pennant if we were with any luck at all. Things happen. Anyway, we went to Cleveland, and we're one game out of first place. But if we win one of those ball games, we're still only a game out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, things happen. We lost both of them. And you know, the guys are kind of rejected. I said, "God damn it." I said, "I just won one." I said, "Geez, we lost two tough balls. We lost two, five, four, something." We continue like work, just hanging in there, winning the ball game, July 3, which is the percentage of men. Just not good.
What do you recall about the confrontation with Nelson Potter?
Well, that was a Mr. Mack. Why, I've never seen him in the years I was there so frustrated in reference to a man's ability at that particular time. And Nelson was a good pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
This particular day, he got banged around. Why, Mr. Mack blew up and just said, "That's it, you're through, you're gone." And he did. And no one ever questioned it, because what would he say in retaliation as to why he thought that way? But that hurt our ball.
It's kind of a shock, the kind of thing that players sitting there can't believe this is happening.
That was it. We couldn't believe it. What are you going to say? Isn't that
true? No, I guess I know.
It was said in the papers, and the writers wrote it, and he made a terrible mistake. Elliot's a phone guy. I couldn't mention. That was another question. Right?
Yeah.
Heard it sometimes.
They had some more good years after that, too.
Yeah, we had good pitching, but all of a sudden, they called me.
Yeah, all their arms seemed to fall off. Yeah. I want to read you a story that I came across that I thought, but I've come across an awful lot of stories of things that never happened. And I thought you would be in a position to know about this. Final weeks of 1947 season. Pete Suter learns that his father is ill. He wants to get, and the team is in Detroit. He wants to catch a train out of Detroit, a 5 o'clock train to go home. And apparently Suter has been a practical joker. Okay, the way the story reads is, burned by many of Suter's practical jokes in the past, Connie Mack refused to let him leave the club. Knowing Suter wasn't kidding this time, his teammates appealed to umpire Bill Summers. Early in the game, Summers obligingly ejected Suter for an imaginary infraction. Mac called the umpire over to the dugout. "I've already put him out, Mr. Mac," said Summers. "William," said Mac, "all I've got to put in for him is a young boy." "Then trot out the young boy," said Summers. And Mac sent out Nellie Fox. Now, would you say that story is true or not?
To be factual, I wouldn't be able to say positive. I know that she's dead too. Fox did come in as to disposition of it. I'm not positive. I couldn't say yes or no to that. I don't know.
But I thought that if they said that Suter's teammates appealed umpire Bill Summers, I figured that if that was true, you might well have been one of those teammates telling Bill Summers about it.
No, as far as I recall, no. I have no positive recollection to say that's written in the
history.
Because Mr. Mack, I'm sure, is approached
by my friend. Yeah, that part didn't ring true. And it could just be a story somebody made up about the dramatic way that Nellie Fox got started or got
it's
into the game.
That's a possibility. That's
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly right.
And was did Suter have a reputation for practical jokes?
Not in that type of context. No, he was an outgoing, nice guy. As far as practical jokes, I don't know. Now, I did as many things as many of them, like the different Zudo. First year, but he was afraid of mosquitoes. Hey, the man Hibby was afraid. So, this one particular day, one of the kids on the back of the had a rubber lizard. It looked like an alligator, about that long. Black. So, when we were talking about it, So I went up to the upper and I said, "Hey, this guy was on the big place." I said, "You look out there and see what's going on. I'm alligator." I said, "No, I don't care about that." Bill McGill. We were told everybody he's throwing it up in the air. He brought it over to the umpire. He said, "What's that? Here, Bill." We could understand what he was saying. He says, "Oh my God, he's going. I just called the trainer. He's the trainer. I know he was doing it." But, you know, things like that. They used to put tobacco in your gloves and then you throw tobacco. When he was coming in, he'd stick tobacco in your gloves. But those were things that. No, but Suter was not. And that's that type of
time. Yeah. If I come across stuff like that and there's any doubt about it, I just don't use it.
I just don't use it.
If anybody can confirm it, that was there, that's different.
No, I wouldn't. I'll bet Joey would.
Otherwise, I wouldn't. I didn't ask Joe about it because
he
wasn't there.
He wasn't there, that's right.
Yeah.
No, I would say the thing.
Yeah. No, I can't use that. What was it like to? Did you go into Connie Mack's office in the tower to talk contract ever?
We're not arguing. So this one year I said, "Well, what would we sign this contract?" I said, "Well, it's kind of like a talking to me. So I said, "Well, if you sign this contract, go along with things you want to do. This is for you." He said, "I'll take care of this." Clubhouse guy came up and said, just getting in the clubhouse. And then his boss got to me. Great. Put it together, talk to people, getting some people back in the ballpark, and he said, as far as your contact is concerned, so he asked to check the phone back on the phone. I said, my God, that's wonderful. I said, what do you expect? He said, do a job for me, I'll do a job. Some people. So about August, I think it was, scored 149, just one short of the league. He had another job. It's pretty marvelous. He says, put us back to what people want to see. Of course, it's the most reason there wasn't any other sponsors. It was bring the people out there.
Yeah.
There's our money and the concessions. You probably know, the concessions made more money, bottom line, than all the people coming in. And it was always owned by the board itself. That's what Mr. Mack, Mr. Mack, 52 or 53, sold it to Jacob's Brothers.
Well, yeah, it wasn't him. It was his son.
His son. Yeah. His son.
Yeah, Connie Jr. was running it. Connie Jr. was running the concession.
Oh, the concession.
Yeah. He was running the concession.
But he was forced into it by Earl and Roy. Earl and Roy were $2 or something.
They
never did a thing, but born and raised into that family, all they did was baseball. One becomes the general manager. Oh, not the general manager.
Kind of business manager.
And Earl was just a non-entity.
Did you ever see Earl? I heard a story that Earl played a fiddle in the dugout. Anything like that?
Oh, you're in my head. No, he was a bad person. But the terrible thing about the demise of that franchise, well, the newspaper did well. There were, I think at that time, five different families over the years that were part owners of
it
and lived on. But when it came to spring training, they wouldn't come up with any money to keep it in front of the room. I found out how to become a manager.
'48, '49, and then '50 is Mr. Mack's last year. Well, let me back up a minute. What turned you into a home run hitter?
To be positive about it, I don't know. Over at Rochester again, I knew that in my own mind, in my own heart sense, this was it. Which you can't use, but of course that's not true.
Yeah.
It was complete collusion. I had to do something to get back to meetings. And I used to work in meat, meat product company here in H. Martha company in San Francisco. At least I got there, was it? Back in 1940. Bosses were at H. Bobbitt Company in San Francisco, meat packers, at a ball club during the summer. And one of them lived inside the tables down the street. Anyway, Billy Martin played for us, and I got to go to the tournament, making packs for people. And we used to play on Sundays down at San Mateo and doing 5,000 people, which was always good ball game. So all of a sudden, the first thing you know, we used to go to them baseball players, all the difference. They'd show us, they'd give us a knife, and they'd have these cattle running down the dock for you, and cut quarters and a half and a half. And all you did, when the guy was loading the truck, he'd line it up, cut it from the back of the truck. That's all we should do. I'd put the hooks in there, just trivial. Well, anyway, I was there about 2 years, and it was great. They gave us good money. And we had to work. And in so doing, paid us good money and gave us meat for the family for the week. So all of a sudden, my good buddy, commissioner in Kentucky,
Chandler,
someone told him about this. And then he also did it over in Oakland. We had some players over there that used to play for years, I think. Years. So we used to battle with each other. And somebody complained about it, that we were playing past our contract limitations. In other words, in our contract in those days, we could only play up to 30 days after the conclusion of the season.
Mm-hmm.
That you cannot play for pay. In other words, you can't give any gratuities of any kind to play in baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we were doing. And he brings this up and makes himself get out of there. Well, from then on, there's the people that were asked to come back because of that rule. So anyway, we still can't get the high school. But then, next year, the war, of course, has come along, and we can't get guys to work in there. They used to go to different factories and places around San Francisco Bay and make big bucks. So next thing you know, I'm a truck driver. I have now a route to deliver meat, and I have to go to that truck by myself.
Mm-hmm.
I just got it done like I used to do, and I have to learn how to pack it, how to stack it, how to dump.
Mm.
So I did that for about two or three years, like that. And I got strong. I mean, even I could pick up 50-pound lamb if you can't put it on the books and butcher shots. But I think that's what part of it was, that I got strong in that sense, and got quicker. And it's an amazing thing to express it. First time I built the guy, I was behind the plate for nothing. I first put him on. I stood up there and Bill and I were talking. And I said, William, are you sure that pitcher's not too close? He said, man. I thought, God damn it, it wasn't that close last time. I put out these glasses. I said, I wonder. He says, never changed that. He's still in the same place. So I did. It improved my vision.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing I found when I started to hit with them on, I would stand kind of a half-closed stance, a little bit open, but mostly closed. And this part of the glass, I think would be almost at the back of the picture. And I'd see this bird. And I said, geez, I can't look at the ball quick enough. So what I did was make no sense. No problem with my class. And from then on, I had an open stance. But Ted and I were pretty friends. And I used to watch him. So I said, Theodore, goddamn, what can you do to help me? He said, well, I have these solutions in the world. But he said, sometimes you're not in front of you. How do you do it? He said, well, what can I do? He said, I think you can do it too. Put your weight on your back foot. Back leg, and this leg is just hanging there, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Find out, he says, you don't overstride, you don't stride quick. You don't want to stride, you don't stride. You're not up here.
Mm-hmm.
Back here, you're swinging that leg. That's what did it for me. I can wait on the back foot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I should have let the watch him
each
day.
Yeah.
But that's how he taught me. He said, you got to get your weight back. That's the way he taught me.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't teaching that sense. He taught the kids and tell them, you should do this, not to say you can hit like me.
Mm-hmm.
To do this might help. So that's all I suggested. So I did. I opened up my stance, put my weight back here, and just when I pushed the man, I was pulled out.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah. Who, what happens now when Mr. Mack is going downhill? Who is covering for him or picking up for him in the dugout when he's not on top of a game?
Well, when Dykes is there, that's be more so than Adams. And even at the times when Jimmy wasn't here, we had
Simmons was there.
Yeah, but Simmons didn't.
Bing Miller. Yeah.
Bing Miller was good. He's got a good guy. And he knew baseball. He would make Mr. Mack. And you'd do it. We used to do the same thing. He'd give him a dugout behind his helmet. I'd call him a hat and everything. And he'd say, Mr. Mack, you got to do Mr. Mack. Yeah, that's right. So, in other words, he wasn't with it completely.
Yeah.
He knew it.
Yeah.
But to say that he was not a good baseball mind, I wouldn't be able to challenge it in any way, because he was very successful.
Mm-hmm.
But again, look at the lineups. Again, if you've got guys that can play and play to their ability, anybody can be a manager. How many times a year does a manager decision win for? Five, six, seven, that's five.
I guess when it comes to changing pitchers, it's about
this. Well, that's the answer in that sense. Even when I was over in Cincinnati, McKechnie was intelligent usage of pitchers. But you go to the lineup he had as far as four starting pitchers.
Uh-huh.
He had Walters, Derringer, Vandermeer, and Joe Banks. And I mean, these guys could go 9 innings. They'd go down to the bullpen the next day.
Oh, yeah.
And pitch in 9 innings.
Mm-hmm.
They get out to the day, I'll be there for 1 or 2 innings or six, seven pitches, whatever it is.
And then pitch batting practice the next day.
And they pitch 250 innings a year.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's the whole thing today that has astounded me. Why? And all the injuries. Look up over the years. You know, some pitchers with bad arms, that they have shoulder cuffs and elbows and tendons.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to pitch twice as much.
Yeah.
But today, I don't know what it is. They tell them right off. Go five would come get you. That's it.
I'm told that the reason is nobody wants to be saddled with the blame after paying these guys millions of dollars. Being blamed for them having arm trouble because you overworked them. Nobody, no manager, no pitching coach, nobody. They're scared to death of the doctor's report if they overwork them. That's all it is.
There's a possibility that's part of it, but the big part of it is the fact that these guys today, they create jobs, and I say this honestly, man, evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
How many coaches are there on the ball? We used to have two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need somebody else, one of the players, a guy that was catch people out of coach first base.
Well, was Lena Blackburn there when you were there?
No. No, there was Dykes, there was Simmons, there was Big Miller.
Sal Perkins? Who was the third base coach?
Cochran, Simmons was the third base coach. And then later, Wally Moses became the coach.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have great people, I mean, great players.
Yeah. When Mr. Mack retired, was a common feeling among the players? In a sense, it's about time.
Well, I don't think it was ever said.
No. But they knew that he should.
It should.
Yeah.
It should.
And he supposedly said that I managed a year too long.
Which he did say. Yeah. He knew that a couple of years ago. That's why he turned into his ex. Jimmy and I were pretty friends. I can't do it. We should take over.
Mm-hmm.
When I took the job in 54, Jimmy came up to me before he was going home. He was
mm-hmm.
He came up to me and says, "You're going to be the next manager." I said, "Wait a minute." I said, "I'm 31 years old, I'm 35, I'm 37, I'm 36, I'm 37, 37. He says, "That's not the point." He said, "You can still play." He said, "They can't afford to hire me."